Middle East Studies at Marine Corps University presents The Palestinians in the Arab Spring by Professor Amir Litvak, Alliance Center for Iranian Studies, Tel Aviv University. Amir Litvak is an associate professor at the Department of Middle Eastern History and the director of the Alliance Center for Iranian Studies at Tel Aviv University. Professor Litvak's field of expertise include modern Shia and Iranian history and modern Palestinian history. He is the author and editor of a number of books and articles on modern Shia and Iranian history, as well as on Palestinian nationalism. Professor Litvak received his PhD from Harvard in 1991. This lecture took place Thursday, 7 February 2013, at Marine Corps University, Marine Corps Base, Quantico, Virginia.
Studies on various topics. This year we didn't have a specific country or region. We just work with the Middle East, and we are indeed very fortunate to have a colleague and, if I may say, a friend come here to us to speak about the Palestinians and the Arab Uprising. Professor Amir Litvak, who is the Alliance Center for Iranian Studies Director at the Tel Aviv University in Israel, comes to us from far away. He will talk about the Palestinian to say that he will take questions on his other hat that he wears, which is the Iranian subject. And also, before we start, I'd like to acknowledge Dr. Morris. Thank you for being here, for our board of visitors, Brigadier Tariq Kur Ahmed from the Embassy of the Kingdom of Bahrain and Marines, friends of Marine Corps University. Welcome aboard. We have the biography of Professor Litvak there, but Professor Litvak received his PhD from close to us, Harvard, and he's an associate professor at the Department of Middle East History and the director of Alliance, as I told you. Professor Litvak's field of expertise include modern Shia and Iranian history and modern Palestinian history. He is the author and editor of a number of books and articles on modern Shia and Iranian history, as well as on Palestinian nationalism. And you can see the list of some of his publications on the this piece of paper out there. And I also will give you an announcement for the next talk. It is on Iran's nuclear dossier in relations with the United States. The speaker is Ambassador Said Hossein Mousavian. Ambassador Mousavian was Iran's ambassador to Germany, and then he was the spokesperson for the National Security Council. He is maybe the highest Iranian official who is in the United States. He's at Princeton right now. He will give you the Iranian, not the current government. He has had some fallings with Mr. Ahmadinejad, but he still is representing the Iranian government. So it is, I think, a special opportunity for us to listen to someone from that side. That will be on the 27th of February at 1330 to 1500. If you're not on our list, please talk to Adam Seitz, sitting right there in the corner, and he will put you on the list. But it's open to public. You're more than welcome. Without any further ado, Professor Litvak, thank you again for coming and accepting our invitation. The floor is yours.
Thank you very much. Let me, like every good Israeli politician, let me say two things before I start talking. First of all, it's really a great honor for me to be here. And very serious about it. When I was a teenager, I used to read a lot about the exploits of the Marines. So for me to speak to the Marine Corps University is something very, very special, I have to say. Secondly, I'm an academic. I represent myself. I don't represent my government. And I represent my own personal views on the situation in the Middle East, on the Palestinian issue. I would start with saying that the Palestinians today are in the midst of a major national crisis. Because of the split between the two governments, the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank and the Hamas government in Gaza. And the split is, in a sense, traumatic for the Palestinians. It threatens their national movement. I would say, following the national trauma of the civil war, internal Palestinian civil war of the 1930s, and I would say it goes against almost a sacrosanct principle of Palestinian politics of the 1960s of maintaining national unity. One of the major slogans of Yasser Arafat when he headed the PLO was one what he called Palestinian independence of decision making, but the other issue was a unity of representation, that is, that there would be one body representing the Palestinians. Now we have two bodies, two governments, each of them claiming to be the true representative of the Palestinian people. For the Palestinians, this is a major crisis and a major problem. I would even go further. The longer this split continues, the more difficult it will become to heal it, the more difficult it will become to restore national unity. I'll expand on it later. You said the more institutionalized it becomes. Even if there is some sort of reconciliation, I doubt very much whether or not it will be a genuine reconciliation. But, and again, I'll elaborate on it. The second point, before I go into details, I would say that the Palestinians have been deeply affected by the Arab uprising. I don't like the term Arab Spring, by the way. I think it is turning to something much less pleasant than Spring. The Palestinians have been deeply affected by the Arab uprising, but so far they have not taken part, or we don't see an uprising in Palestinian ranks. And I would say, I would think of two reasons why so far nothing has happened in the Palestinian territories. One, I would say, is that there is still, especially in the West Bank, partial democracy, and that is a major factor in diffusing the resentment that led to some of the Arab uprisings. And secondly, is the trauma or the pain caused by the recent Palestinian-Israeli clash from 2001 to 2007, which still has its imprint on the Palestinian psyche. And what I want to go now, elaborate a little bit, is on the, what is going on how the two parts of the Palestinian National Movement, how they're faring in this current situation, mainly the West Bank government under the leadership of Fatah, or the PLO, and the Hamas government in Gaza. I very, very briefly on the two major points of difference between these two movements. Fatah is a nationalist movement of, I would say, the old school of Arab nationalism. It is not secular in the sense of anti-religious, but it is secular in the sense that it is not, does not put Islam as its major ideology. It regards Islam as a component of Palestinian national and cultural identity. It puts its major emphasis on national liberation of the Palestinian people against Israel, and since the mid-1970s, Fatah has accepted the existence of Israel first de facto, later de jure. And Fatah today is looking for a political settlement or a peaceful solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, and of course at their own conditions. Hamas is different. Hamas, and I will elaborate more on Hamas, Hamas is a religious nationalist movement for which Islam is the major component of their ideology. It is a Muslim Brotherhood movement, eventually seeking to establish an Islamic state on the entire territory of Palestine, following the elimination of Israel as a state. But Hamas has also been able to integrate Palestinian nationalism into its own ideology, and this combination of Islam and nationalism is one of the strong points of Hamas as a movement, in addition to the another aspect is being a very successful social movement. Now, Fatah today is in a major crisis, which has been going on for the past 10 or 15 years. And the crisis is several folds. One is that in this current Arab upheaval, Fatah belongs to the past, in a sense. Fatah is part of the old Arab elites, the old nationalist elites that have suffered a major setback or major defeats in Arab countries, such as Egypt, Yemen, Tunisia, Syria. It is associated with these elites in the minds of many of young Palestinians. It has been dependent on Arab leaders. So this is one problem. Another problem is that Fatah has failed to deliver on three major issues. It has failed to deliver a Palestinian state yet, partly because of their own faults, partly because of Israeli policies. I will elaborate. It has failed to build a state, or an efficient, what we call surrogate state. Here I want to elaborate a little bit. Once the Palestinian Authority was established in 1994 as an autonomy, the Palestinians had a choice between focusing on state building and focusing on what I will call continuing their, what Arafat, Nasser Arafat, the leader of the PLO, used to say, their revolutionary path. Fatah chose as a conscious decision not to abandon the revolutionary path. It did not transform itself into a political party. It retained some of its characteristics as a movement, as a revolutionary movement. More important, Arafat failed as a state builder. He did not focus his efforts on state building, but maintained its revolutionary aspects. So let me give you two examples. Thomas Friedman once wrote an article that he checked on Google. The words Yasser Arafat education, Yasser Arafat road building, Yasser Arafat sewage. To see how much Arafat spoke about these mundane issues, he found none. Arafat never really bothered himself with these mundane issues, while focusing on other things. Again, I would say the Israeli government was not helpful in some of these things, but this was a major failure. Nowadays, since 2007, the Palestinians had a different government, with not only Abu Mazen on the top, but a Palestinian prime minister, Salam Fayyad, was a different kind of a leader. For the first time in Palestinian history, Palestinians have a leader who cares more about state building, about building the society from below, than about the continuing the revolutionary path. Fayyad has been a former World Bank official. He used to live several years in the US, so he takes a different role. He focused on this institutional building. Unfortunately, however, Fayyad suffers from three major weaknesses. He doesn't have a broad social base. He doesn't have a political base. He's not supported by Fatah. In fact, most Fatah people dislike Fayyad because he's not a politician. He didn't bring many Fatah people into his administration. And he's too dependent on foreign donations. Fayyad is being attacked on all sides for being, I would say, both too soft toward the Israelis, for in fact doing the Israelis' job by building a state under Israeli occupation. He's being accused of in fact helping the Israelis of maintaining what is called a cheap occupation. He's also being accused of being anti-democratic, because there have been no elections in the Palestinian Authority for the past since 2006. Another failure of Fayyad was his failure to build a sound economic base for the nascent state or surrogate state in the West Bank. In fact, the Palestinian Authority is still heavily dependent or totally dependent on foreign donations. The Palestinian Authority is the largest recipient in the world of human aid, of foreign aid per capita for the past 18 years since it was established. So this is a major weakness for the Palestinian Authority and for the Fayyad government. Another failure of Fatah is that Fatah has failed to integrate the new generation of activists into its own leadership. The PLO leadership, the Palestinian Authority leadership, the Fatah leadership is still dominated by the old leadership that came from Tunis in 1994 and has not been able to integrate the younger generations of Fatah activists. Equally bad, the middle generation of Fatah activists, the people who carried the first intifada of 1987 to 1994 on their back, what we used to call the Dakhlans and the Rajoubs, that is the people who were the backbone of the Fatah leadership, proved to be a disappointment. When they received positions of power, usually in the military apparatus of the Palestinian Authority, they eventually evolved into fairly inefficient and corrupt officials, especially Dakhlan in Gaza, who lost control of Gaza partly because of his misconduct. Fatah was not able to bring in more sophisticated, more educated, more dedicated younger generation into its leadership, and this leadership gap is a major failure or weakness of Fatah. By the way, compared with Hamas, Hamas has been much more successful in integrating the new generation. I would say partly, ironically, thanks to Israeli, to inadvertent Israeli support, because when Israel killed Hamas leaders, it opened the ranks to younger people to move up, and Hamas, with preparing itself for attacks by Israelis, groomed a new generation of leaders in reserve to move forward if the predecessor would be killed. So Hamas has been much more successful in integrating this generation, new generation, into its leadership. Fatah has proven to be a total failure. And finally, I would say Fatah, as I said, failed to deliver a state yet. Then maybe, hopefully, things will improve in the future. So this is, I would say, roughly on the failure of failures of Fatah. I will go later on discussing the more immediate impact of the Arab upheaval. If I move to Hamas, Hamas today is in much better shape than Fatah. Hamas is a much more successful movement than Fatah. And because of, I would say, three reasons. One is that Hamas combines both religion and nationalism in its ideology, whereas Fatah had only nationalist ideology. Fatah never had social ideology. Fatah never had anything to say about the economy, about social issues. It focused only on the political field. Hamas has more to say on these things. Hamas has the background of a social movement, of building this vast network of social welfare institutions, what you call the Dawah system, that builds support from the system, typical of the Muslim Brotherhood movement anywhere in the Middle East. Hamas has found a smart combination of, I would say, ideological rigidity on the long run and political pragmatism in the short run. That is, Hamas ideologically is still committed to the elimination of Israel as a state, to the establishment of an Islamic state in the entire territory of Palestine. But Hamas has found a formula to, while keeping this ideal alive, it has developed a strategy of accepting, I would say, temporary, what they call ceasefires or lulls in the fighting against Israel, as part of a long-term strategy of what they call mukawama, or resistance. That is, according to this new strategy, the struggle with Israel will be a long-term, possibly decades-long war of attrition, in which in this war of attrition, tactical victories do not count, loss of territory does not count. What matters is if you are able to bleed the enemy and eventually to weaken the enemy until it will collapse from within at some point in the future. This strategy of mukawama or resistance enables Hamas to cease fighting temporarily for periods of several years in order to rebuild, replenish its forces, its power in vis-a-vis the enemy, or also, by the way, to build a strong society in its own territory. Hamas is even willing publicly to sign an armistice with Israel, not full peace, not recognition of Israel, not acceptance of Israel as a legitimate state, but sign an armistice agreement for a specific period of time in return for a full Israeli withdrawal from Palestinian territories and the return of Palestinian refugees to pre-67 Israel. Now, since its takeover of Gaza in 2007, I would say that Hamas is not torn, but Hamas has to find a compromise between five different agendas that it faces. And here I wrote something very briefly. I would say Hamas is a government. As a government, Hamas has to take care of people, to provide social services, food, security to the people of Gaza. And as a government, they've been fairly successful. Unlike Fatah, for instance, Hamas at the beginning crushed all unruly armed opposition, so private militias. Hamas restored law and order in Gaza, compared with the semi-anarchy that had existed under the Palestinian Authority. They built a more efficient governmental system than Fatah. But as a government, of course, Hamas is obliged to behave restraintly against vis-a-vis Israel and other parts. So Hamas is a government. Hamas is an Islamic movement that wants to impose its Islamic worldview on the population. To give you an example, only a week ago, Hamas had issued a law that forces all female students in the school system and university school system to wear the hijab, to wear the scarf, and as a state law. Hamas is not pursuing a full state, a full Sharia state, but is gradually trying to implement its Islamic agenda, for instance, by establishing what they call sulh committees, or that is, committees that would negotiate or adjudicate conflict between people according to Islamic tradition. So they are moving very cautiously and slowly into advancing their Islamic agenda, but they won't going to do it too roughly, you know, not to alienate the people. Hamas is also a social movement, again building this vast network of social institutions, welfare institutions. Sorry, I should have. No, this should have been a political movement. Sorry. Hamas is a political movement that eventually wants to take over not only the West Bank government or the Palestinian Authority, but the PLO and the entire Palestinian movement. And Hamas is also a jihadi movement committed to the fight against Israel. Now, there is no way you can reconcile all five issues. For instance, if you want to pursue jihad against Israel constantly, then you will not be able to provide social services to your people, or get foreign support, or reach some sort of a political agreement with the Palestinian Authority. If you want to achieve reconciliation with the Palestinian Authority, or get recognition from foreign countries, then you need to give up, at least temporarily, on the jihadi issue. If you want to push too much the Islamic agenda, then you may risk your political agenda. So Hamas has been trying in the past 6 years or so to find the golden path between these two conflicting desires by, at certain points, going on one direction, at another point, going on another direction. That is, you had periods of clashes with Israel, low-level warfare, or sending missiles to Israel targets without trying to provoke Israel to a full-scale conflict. At the same time, again, gradually pursuing the Islamic agenda and social agenda. This is how Hamas has been conducting itself in the past 7 years now. Another problem that Hamas is facing is, once it became a government, is the tension between what is called the external leadership, that is the leadership that set in Damascus, and the internal leadership, that is the Gaza government. Historically, since the early 1990s, there was a division of labor between the external leadership that was responsible for strategy, for foreign relations, and the local leadership that was responsible for, I would say, building the infrastructure of Hamas. Politically, the external leadership was more powerful because they had the money and they had the legitimacy of deciding on strategic matters. They used to say that since they are free of daily Israeli pressure, they can see the whole picture, they can see the long-term strategy and not give up on the national goals for tactical achievements. However, since the Arab uprising, there have been two major changes in this division of labor. Following the civil war in Syria, Hamas had to remove its offices from Damascus elsewhere. That is, Hamas had to sever its relations with the Syrian government, or with what used to be called the resistance camp in the Middle East. That is, Iran, Syria, Hezbollah in Lebanon, Hamas, and some other radical organizations, against the, what we used to call the pro-settlement, not Israeli settlement, but the political settlement camp in the Middle East. By moving away from Damascus and moving its offices both either to Cairo or to Qatar, Hamas had to change its allegiance and become more dependent on the other camp. Hamas, in a sense, had to be more restrained in its conduct vis-a-vis Israel, following both Egyptian pressures and Qatari pressures to follow the more political path than the jihadi path. This shift weakened temporarily the external leadership vis-a-vis the internal leadership, that in the meantime built its own power base, especially thanks to its military force. Now, inside the internal leadership, it's also split or divided between two factors: the government, headed by Ismail Haniyeh, and the military force headed by Jabari, who was killed by Israel a few months ago, with the military force becoming the major power broker inside Gaza. This was the situation until the recent clash between Israel and Hamas in Gaza. Before the clash, as I said, the external leadership was weakened, so much so that Khaled Mashal, the head of the Hamas political bureau, or the nominal head of Hamas, thought of even resigning his position or not running for his position as leader of Hamas in the next internal Hamas elections. Because of his weakened position, he was trying to achieve reconciliation with the Palestinian Authority in order, in my view, to take over the Palestinian Authority from within. The Gaza leadership did not wish to achieve this reconciliation. Even though the Gaza leadership is committed to the idea of reconciliation in order to restore West Bank-Gaza unity, they were afraid of losing their own, I would say, local turf in Gaza. They preferred to maintain their absolute control over Gaza than overtaking the risk that reconciliation with the Palestinian Authority would undermine their control of Gaza, and therefore they were reluctant to pursue any kind of reconciliation with the Palestinian Authority, so much so that Mashal thought of resigning. However, following the Israeli Hamas clash a few months ago, Mashal's position has been strengthened. I would say that while Hamas suffered a military blow from Israel, politically and strategically, Hamas has come out stronger following this clash with Israel. Because Hamas, rightly or wrongly, was perceived by many Palestinians as being able to hit Israel, major Israeli cities, with missiles. It doesn't matter if the missiles were shut down. The fact that they could threaten major Israeli cities seemed to be important. Hamas was perceived as someone who is being able to challenge the Israelis to not cave in to Israeli demands. And Hamas received, I would say, international prestige when, following this clash with Israel, Arab foreign ministers came to Gaza, Turkish foreign minister, that is, Hamas is being increasingly recognized as at least equal to the Palestinian Authority, if not more so. Now, Mashal, with support of Egypt and Qatar, is in a much stronger position, and Mashal is grooming himself to be the future leader of the entire Palestinian national movement, of, I would say, taking over the West Bank government and the PLO through elections. And if we believe opinion polls, would there be elections now in the West Bank, Hamas will have major gains. I'm not sure that it will have an absolute majority. But in Gaza, in my view, elections will not be free and fair. So Hamas will have full control of Gaza, plus major gains in the West Bank. Hamas would be poised to take over the PLO. This is one reason why, in my view, the prospects of elections are not that great. But I would say, this Hamas is now, in this regard, is on the rise. Now, another important development is if you look at Hamas and Iran. Following the events in Syria, Hamas had to downgrade its relations with Iran, but this relation has not been severed completely. In fact, Iran continued to support Hamas. Hamas publicly thanked Iran for supporting it in the recent clash against Israel. But on the other hand, Iran is building an alternative to Hamas in Gaza. Iran has been equipping the Islamic Jihad organization, a smaller, more radical organization than Hamas, with missiles, mid-range missiles, hundreds of such missiles that can reach today Tel Aviv. While Islamic Jihad still accepts Hamas leadership or seniority, while Islamic Jihad has agreed to the ceasefire that brokered by Egypt with Israel, Islamic Jihad is there to violate the ceasefire once they decide it is in their interest, within their interest. Hamas has violated its principle that it followed when it took power in Gaza of not allowing rival militias to survive. That is, initially they tried to eliminate all rivals, but now they have allowed, in a sense, inadvertently or inadvertently, Islamic Jihad to emerge as a potential major rival for Hamas in Gaza, which again may pose a problem for them. Another challenge for Hamas is the Salafi challenge in Sinai, that or of the rise of Salafi elements in Gaza, who may ally themselves with Salafi elements in Sinai, who will possibly ignite another clash with Israel, in either in order to provoke Hamas or to push Hamas to the corner. this may pose a problem for Hamas. And you can also say, interestingly enough, although Hamas is a Muslim Brotherhood movement, Egypt is dominated by a Muslim Brotherhood government. Relations between Hamas and Egypt are not that wonderful. When it comes to Egyptian national interests, Egypt follows its own national interests at the expense of Hamas. When there was a fuel shortage in Egypt, Egypt stopped fuel shipments to Gaza. Egypt did not open the Gaza-Egyptian border completely the way Hamas wanted, because Egypt does not want a free flow of Gazans to its own territory. So there is sympathy, there is cooperation, but it's not unlimited. And again, Egyptians are taking their own interest first, giving the first priority. Now, what have been the impact of the Arab uprising on the Palestinians? You can speak of several important ramifications. One is that in the Middle East as a whole, the more moderate camp, what we used to call the pro-political settlement camp, has been weakened significantly with the fall of Mubarak, with the fall of the Tunisian government, or and it was replaced by Islamist movements that are officially against any kind of a peaceful settlement with Israel, although they may accept it as, unwillingly or because they have no choice. More importantly, Fatah, as I said, belongs in this sense to the older generation of Arab politics, whereas Hamas belongs to the new wave of Arab politics. On the political side, Fatah, or the Palestinian Authority, has lost its major allies. Mubarak was the major sponsor of the PA government. He was a major sponsor of Abu Mazen. With Mubarak gone and being replaced by a Muslim Brother government in Egypt, Abu Mazen lost a major ally, Hamas gained a major ally. Jordan, being afraid of its own security, has to take a more middle course between Fatah and Hamas. We can see it with King Abdullah hosting Khaled Mashal recently. King Abdullah, in fact, trying to pursue reconciliation between Hamas and the Palestinian Authority in order to diffuse tensions inside Jordan as part of his policy to find some sort of modus vivendi with his own Islamic camp. So this has weakened the Palestinian Authority vis-a-vis Hamas on the one hand. Another problem for the Palestinian Authority is that with a more Islamist Middle East, with Arab governments more attentive to Arab public opinion, which historically has been more hostile to Israel, which historically has been more stringent in its attitude toward Israel, the margin of maneuverability that the Palestinian Authority had has narrowed down. It will be much more difficult for any Palestinian government to make concessions in future negotiations with Israel and receive Arab backing for such concessions, because Arab governments will have to think about their own public opinion before pressuring the Palestinians to make any concessions. Another problem is that our world today, our leaders today, are much more busy in their own domestic affairs, and they have less, even though they sympathize with the Palestinians, I would say they have much less time to spend on the Palestinian issue than on other issues. The major event is let's say, Syrian civil war, which attracts attention in the Middle East. This is the main battle line arena in the Middle East. Or the Persian Gulf tension between Arab countries and Iran, or Egyptian domestic problems. This marginalizes the Palestinian issue. Again, it's important emotionally, but it is less as a central issue politically. Another problem, again, here I'm saying as an Israeli, with my own private opinion, the prospects of a two-state solution have diminished in recent months. And for several reasons, I would say. Partly, I would say, Israeli fault. I did not speak much about Israel, but I would say I think the Israeli government has not behaved smartly in recent years. Israel has made several mistakes. Israelis feel, rightly or wrongly, that the peace process with the Palestinian Authority failed. That is, by following the 1994 agreement, Israelis perceived terrorism instead. And therefore, attitudes toward or more reconciliatory feelings in Israel have cooled down. Israeli public opinion shifted not necessarily to the support of settlers, but against, I would say, become less conciliatory. Israelis have become much less, I would say, optimistic about prospects of genuine peace in the Middle East, much more skeptical, and therefore much less willing to make some of the necessary concessions. Second issue has been Israeli settlement policy, which in my view, again, I mean, I'm speaking for myself, has been the most idiotic Israeli policy since its establishment. If there is one Israeli policy that threatens the long term of existence of Israel as the land of the country of the Jewish people, there is a settlement policy, because the settlement policy erodes the prospects of a two-state solution and may pave the way for what we call a one-state solution, which means the elimination of the Israeli state as a state of the Jews. This development plays into the hands of Hamas. This development plays into the hands of Arab radicals. I would say it enhances our developments, plus I would say here Israeli stupidity, plays into the hands of those Arabs who are against, or Palestinians who are against the two-state solution, who believe that if things will go on right now, it will be too late to have a two-state solution, and then the only solution would be a one-state solution, the elimination of Israel. So in this regard, the process, unless it is turned to another direction, will be very, helps, I would say, Hamas at the expense of Fatah. Another factor working against a two-state solution is, in my view, the growing disappointment or growing understanding that the future Palestinian state in the West Bank and Gaza, after all the initial joy of having the state independence, would be in fact a poor, miserable state. It would be a very little, small state, a very poor state economically, far behind Israel economically. Let me give you an example, two examples. If you look at GDP per capita today, the gap is that if GDP per capita in Israel today is $30,000 a year. In the West Bank, it is something like $2,000. In Gaza, it is less than $1,000. Even if Gaza will experience 8% growth in the next 20 years, it will only achieve GDP per capita of a third of Israel, excluding population explosion in Gaza and so on. I think these prospects that the future Palestinian state will be a poor state compared to a more prosperous Israeli state, or even a more prosperous Jordanian state, undermine the support for such a solution and enhances or reinforces support for a more radical solution of a one-state solution. So in this regard, the impact, one impact of the Arab uprising has been against this two-state solution, again unless something happens. Now, for instance, a new U.S. effort to regenerate the political process may produce such a change. Now, let me say that, I don't think that under current conditions, the kind of a comprehensive peace treaty that many Israelis had hoped for, or that other parties had hoped for, is possible in the Middle East today. I think that the gap between the parties is too big. I think that the obstacles of a Palestinian split undermine the possibilities of having such an agreement, because whatever agreement Abu Mazen will reach or will sign will be immediately attacked by Hamas as a sellout of Palestinian rights. Anyway, his room for maneuvering will be very narrow. And therefore, I think that we have to make it to change paradigm. That is, instead of thinking of a full, comprehensive peace that will solve all problems, by the way, I don't think all problems can be solved anywhere in the world. What we have to look, in my view, is for a two-state solution, but under a different type of agreement. Let's not call it peace, let's call it something else. Neither side will get what it wants, but it will enable both sides at least to get many of the things they want, and will enable, I think, a certain what I would call tenuous coexistence, but not necessarily peace. In the Middle East, that's more than enough if you look at what's going on today in the Middle East. So I would say I would perhaps stop here and leave time for questions if you have.
Very much. So thank you so much for this very comprehensive and coming in from the region. I think what we have lacked here, we, as I said, we haven't really dealt on the Palestinian issue, and it is an issue that I think because of the wars, because of their upheavals, goes in the back burner, but as you just brought it in, it connects all of the problems in the Middle East in a way, and it also epitomizes the difficulties we've had there for 6 years. So thank you very much for being candid, for being open. This is an academic forum where we allow and we actually welcome to have a open forum. And please have your questions on that. And as I repeat again, Professor Litvak, this is a brochure of his center, which you can see it's Professor Abdelrahim Nejad and that's the Iranian flag. So if you have any questions on the other hat, the main hat he wears, please ask those questions. Just raise your hand, identify yourself, and ask a question. Stop the cigar. Go ahead, please.
I'm Norman Segar. What do you think the prevailing view is now in Israel, looking out at the problem, the dilemma you pointed out between Jewish identity and remaining a democracy, because even the Israeli-Palestinian population is growing across the West Bank. What, looking out a generation, what's the prevailing view? What do people say? How do we deal with that? Not now, but 30 years from now.
I think this is a major dilemma. I would say that those people who support the two-state solution do it mostly because of the need to preserve Israel identity as the state of Jewish people and remaining a democracy. They believe that the other option will eventually lead either to South Africa or to a state with an Arab majority in which the fate of the Jewish minority would at best be very shaky. Let me also add, I think that the recent events in the Middle East have not been very good for minorities in the Middle East. In fact, minorities have been the victims in practically every Arab revolt in the Middle East. The opponents of the two-state solution believe, deny the, what they call the demographic factor. There is an interesting development. I would say two things. One is that if you look at demography, there's been a significant decline of birth rate among Palestinians. I will also say that apparently the Palestinian Authority manipulates some of the statistics of counting Palestinians. I won't go into details. And there is certain possible inflation in the number of Palestinians. So opponents of the two-state solution believe that demography is not such a major danger, that Israel can manage even with, let's say, 30 to 40% Arab population. Other people say it doesn't matter. When you have a 40% population or 39% or 42%, it becomes at best a binational state. This is the dilemma. And I would say that it is the dilemma between those who believe in historical processes and those who believe in, I would say, supernatural historical processes. Somehow God will intervene, or I don't know, some other miracle will happen. This is the major debate. Now, regarding Israeli Palestinians, I think the situation is different because, again, here the demographic, their birth rate has declined significantly. That is, they are roughly 20% population. Most of them, as much as they may dislike certain aspects of Israeli policy, ironically prefer to remain Israeli citizens than, for instance, becoming future citizens of the future Palestinian state. There have been many polls conducted, including people who live on the Israeli West Bank border. There are 14 towns, Arab towns, on this border. 69% of the people who live in these towns prefer to remain Israeli citizens and become, have their towns be part of the Palestinian state. As much as they may be unhappy with many aspects of Israeli policy, jokingly we say because of two things, universal health care and social security, you can say, and maybe also some democratic aspects. So this is not a major problem. This is a problem, again, and I'm not saying that everything is perfect, many things are, should be alleviated, but this is a soluble problem. Having the West Bank and Israel together is a non-soluble problem.
Please.
There used to be some hope of an attracting factor in the West Bank if a technocratic government could Buddhist economic growth, that that would change things on the ground, a model that would improve. But your description of things is that that's not working. Is there really no hope for that anymore, or with some fixes could that still develop?
I didn't say no hope. I think it's facing several major difficulties. One is that Fayyad was very efficient building state institutions. He's been very efficient fighting corruption. What he has been less successful is in building a solid economic base. There is very little investment in the West Bank on industrialization, on developing, I would say, businesses that can provide a solid independent base. Partly, by the way, I think because the Palestinians here would say have been addicted to foreign aid. And partly because of some Israeli policies. Again, I'm not trying to say that Israel has no part in it. Israel could have been more helpful. I think, by the way, that if you look at the current Israeli policy, punishing the Palestinian government, the Western government, for turning to the UN may be a good policy domestically, but you undermine the people you want to keep as your future partners, and you help Hamas. Again, from a strategic point of view, in my view, it's a foolish Israeli policy. But what is needed is, I think, to put greater emphasis on investments that would build a productive base for the future Palestinian state. Unless that happens, then we might end up with another failed state that is unable to support its people, that is, again, would be totally dependent on foreign aid, with all that comes with it.
Colonel Lewis, please.
Mike Lewis, when you're analyzing a conflict for its ripeness for resolution, one of the things to look at is kind of popular fatigue, because that undermines the ability for the elite to maintain a certain platform. Hamas seems to get that a little bit by providing the social services piece, but still, as we just discussed, it's not a great place to live. How much of a factor is this popular fatigue in potentially leading to a quicker resolution or some kind of solution that's driven by the population rather than by the hard elites?
Popular fatigue is definitely a factor, for instance, why there's been no, so far, another third uprising. I think the Palestinian people have paid a very high price for the second clash from 2000-2007. I think there's fear among many Palestinians that the third round will be even more harmful. In that regard, there is a support for some sort of political solution. The problem, of course, is the price that each side has to pay. On the Israeli side, I would say certainly popular fatigue or the realization that long-term occupation is not tenable has been one reason why the centrist party has made such a gain in the recent elections in Israel. Now, this party is not a left-wing party that says go give everything, but it says you cannot continue with the current policy. The problem is that fatigue may be enough to prevent another clash. Will it be enough to push leaders toward making the right political decisions, toward the necessary political concessions on both sides? This is a different issue. We are not so sure. Because the opponents of any kind of solution are powerful, and they may resort to violence, which is what we have seen in the past. And therefore, again, the prospects for, in my view, again, of a comprehensive political solutions are not that great, but possibility of, let's say, making more temporary arrangements, but eventually leading to some sort of a political settlement, which will less than comprehensive, is possible.
Please,
I'd like to hear a little more about the triangle connecting Hamas, the Palestinian Islamic Jihad, and Iran. It has been commonplace for people to describe Hamas as an Iranian proxy. Was that ever true? Is it true now? Is Hamas, is Palestinian Islamic Jihad an Iranian proxy? And if so, how does Iran intend to use it?
Okay, I would say the difference is that Hamas worked with Iran, Islamic Jihad worked for Iran. And I want to elaborate. Hamas was happy to receive Iranian support. Hamas has been always saying, we are willing to, we'll be happy to get any support from any party that will help us fight against Israel, but not at the cost of becoming a satellite for this country. To give an example, Hamas received military support from Iran, logistical support, training from Iran, and from Hezbollah, and so on. But when Iran has a conflict with the UAE over the three islands in the Persian Gulf or in the Gulf, Hamas says we are not party to this conflict. We are not side with Iran or against Iran. Islamic. So this has been, I would say, a marriage of convenience between Iran and Hamas. This is why when Hamas, following the Syrian civil war, Hamas reluctantly, I would say, had to leave Damascus because we could no longer side with a government that is slaughtering Sunnis. And had to take some distance away from the Syrian government and so forth, from Iran to Iran's anger. But Iran did not sever its relations with Hamas. On the other hand, Islamic Jihad historically has been much more dependent on Iran, both ideologically, because Islamic Jihad always regarded Iran as the only true leader of the Middle East, from the times of Khomeini, because Khomeini was the only Muslim leader who understood correctly the Palestinian issue and the need to eliminate Israel completely. And Islamic Jihad, since it lacked the social infrastructure of Hamas, was always much more dependent on Iran. So Islamic Jihad has always been closer to Iran and very much following, I would say, Iranian instructions. Hamas would receive Iran advice, but not instructions. If this Iran advice would be against its own interest, it would not follow them. And again, you can see right now, when Iran was unhappy, let's say, with the ceasefire achieved between Hamas and Israel, Egypt was the major broker, but Hamas followed, had to go along with Egypt against Iranian wish.
I was wondering if you could speak to the Hashemite Kingdom of Jordan and the possibility of the collapse of that regime in the face of the increasing Palestinian population, what that means for the future of the West Bank and perhaps the Palestinians.
Okay. I would say two things about Jordan. Jordan, I think, is in a very dire situation today for three major reasons. One is the economic crisis. But I would say Jordan is facing an almost insoluble dilemma here, and I want to elaborate a little bit. If Jordan has a problem that historically the East Bankers, original East Bankers have been the people in the state apparatus and the army, or the security apparatus, the Palestinians have been the middle class. Historically, the East Bankers have been the mainstay of the Jordanian kingdom, the Palestinians have been again, the middle class, but not had no political influence. The problem is that Jordan can no longer maintain this situation because of its economic crisis. Jordan has to reduce its army or state apparatus. One thing. Secondly, the policies of King Abdullah in trying to rejuvenate the Jordan economy benefit the Palestinians. They benefit at the expense of the East Bankers. The dilemma here is that whatever is essential economically is bad politically. You harm your constituency. Whatever is good politically is harmful economically. And then this is what do you do in such a dilemma? Now, what happened in Jordan in recent years, the King Abdullah's policies, let's put this way. King Hussein was a political genius, but he was not an economist. Abdullah is much better on economics, he's not as good a politician as his father. Abdullah has alienated the Jordanian or the East Bank constituency, both because of his economic policy, partly, I would say, because of his personal conduct. Again, I would say here as an outsider. Abdullah has not been able to cultivate the correct relations with the East Bankers, with the East Bank tribes, and so on. Unlike his father, who used to pay a lot of attention to the tribes, used to go on a weekly basis to each, let's say, each day, each week to another tribe, would say, sit on the ground, eat rice with his hand, and listen to their problems. King Abdullah is more restrained. He is more... He's too westernized. He's too American in this regard.
British.
Too British. But he also studied at Georgetown. He speaks English, you know, his English used to be much better than his Arabic in the past. So he was not able to cultivate this, I would say, strong personal relations with the tribes, and he alienated the tribes. So if you look at what has been happening in Jordan in this in the past year, you would see more demonstrations in the southern part of Jordan, which historically had been the mainstay of the Jordan regime. And they now the East Bankers don't want to talk to the monarchy. They are unhappy with Abdallah. He wants to be even nastier. They are unhappy with the conduct of his wife. Maybe it is easier to blame the wife for the leader's conduct, but his wife is unpopular. She's a Palestinian. She's unpopular among the East Bankers, or maybe she's an easy target. So there is a problem. Now, I don't think that the Palestinians today pose the major problem. Or another problem, by the way, is the growing sense of confidence of the Islamic movement. The Islamic movement in Jordan is one, but inside it is split according to what they call hawks and doves, hardliners and more softliners. The hardliners are more the Palestinians. Even within the Islamic movement, the more pragmatists are the East Bankers. There is a potential long-term danger. Now, should, let me say, God forbid, that there will be a change of government in Jordan, from an Israeli point of view, it would be a strategic disaster. Because the Israeli-Jordan border is the longest border, it is the most vulnerable border, it would pose a major, major problem for Israel. Now, on the other hand, with the problems that are going on now with Palestinian Authority, or the difficulties Palestinian Authority is facing, there have been now rare voices speaking about maybe a possible future confederation between the Palestinian state and the Jordanian state. In my view, if this will happen, this will be a wonderful solution. In the long run, I think this will be an excellent solution to the Palestinians and Jordanians, because the Jordan and the West Bank need each other economically and socially. By the way, differences are not that great between them socially and nationally. In the long run, this will be a very good solution, but it requires imagination and will and which are lacking in the Middle East. This is what I would say about, now, again, from this point of view, this could be a very good solution, a future confederation between Jordan and the West Bank.
Just as a follow-up on this, Gaza will be included.
If possibly, yes. If it could be done, it would be done. In my view, it would be a very good solution.
But your Ministry of Defense says that's untenable because of the position. You need to maintain strategic control of the Jordan Valley for the sake of the narrow waist of Israel.
I'm not a military guy, but I would say that there is a debate in Israel about the military necessity of controlling the Jordan River comparing to the greater danger of having the one state in our country. So let's put it this way. In the Middle East, you have to, I would say two ways. What is the less, you have to prefer the lesser evil, or you have to prefer what can be done to enter your dreams. And this is the way, and one thing, secondly, I don't think we should look to then utopias, we should look to practical solutions. And therefore, in my view, this is the preferred solution. But again, I speak for myself.
Yes, please.
I just had a question in regards to the background of social movement that you had mentioned in regards to Hamas and how effective they've been. What are the additional agendas of Hamas's social movement aside from the integration of the newer generation? And if this is effective, what's the most effective conduit of information, whether it's through the locals or key leaders? What is their way of creating this profound social movement?
Well, Hamas followed the tradition of the Muslim Brothers of providing social services on a local basis, from kindergartens to healthcare clinics to charity, to youth clubs to clubs for all these people. And of course, in return to receiving the social services, you have to follow a certain way of life and participate in Hamas activities and so on. This social policy, by the way, is effective and wonderful as long as you're in opposition, by the way. Because this is what I would call a distributive policy, it's not a productive policy. That is, it is wonderful when you have the means and money to be nice to the people, it does not build a solid economic base for a future independent state. What Hamas has failed, and by the way, not only Hamas, if you look at practically every Islamic movement in the Middle East, or every, and now we have Islamist governments in the Middle East. None of them have any practical solutions of improving productivity in the Middle East. Here I would say, I would be blunt. Islam is a religion. Islam as a religion historically put greater emphasis on morality, on piety, on spirituality. It paid less emphasis and tension or attention on building a solid economic base. So it speaks about social justice, but it never spoke about, again, how do you produce wealth, not how you distribute wealth. And when you see it in Egypt, Morsi in Egypt doesn't have any better solution for Egypt's economic problems than Mubarak had. He may be nicer, he may be less corrupt for the time being, but doesn't have any real panaceas for Egypt. And neither will Hamas. So these policies are good to, again, as long as you are a social movement, it is less sufficient as government. The advantage was that many Arab governments have been totally inefficient in providing these social services. Again, the Palestinian Authority was a very inefficient, corrupt government under Arafat. Now it is different. So was the Egyptian government.
Can I ask a related question? I'm Matthew Sloan, professor in command of staff policy. I teach the cyber electives, so the question I have is, and I wouldn't have thought of it until she asked that question, and you had also talked about Hamas being a more modern outlook. Is social networking something they think about? Is it a shortcut to achieve social goals? Is it ignored? Is there any internet technological reliance forthcoming, or do they see an opportunity with that technology?
Oh, Hamas has been very effective in using the internet for years. Hamas had had very effective websites. I've been using them for years. It has very effective. It has been very active on the internet for years. Hamas has been very efficient using technologies. The Hamas always prides itself on not being the Taliban. They're sort of modernist Islam. By the way, not democratic Islam. I should have said that Hamas is not a democratic government. Hamas has been a very oppressive government in Gaza against Fatah people, against its political opponents. Hamas, I would say, if future Islamist governments in the Middle East would follow the Hamas path, then we don't have prospects for democracy, because Hamas has been an anti-democratic government. But it has been attentive government to public opinion, or in the sense of how far you go in pursuing your policies. Now, again, I think that their social policies are very general, are more, again, the slogan of social justice is wonderful, but it doesn't, social justice, when they speak of social justice, it would be something dear, and forgive me for intervening in American politics, it would be something like compassion conservatism. Okay? This is the idea. That is, you maintain a free market with some compassion. It's not aggressive capitalism, but it is capitalism with a certain more human face. But not much beyond that. It doesn't go into the specifics of how you run an economy. Dr. Wilson?
Dr. Tarji twice made the offer for you to speak on Iran, so we'll take advantage of that and ask you to speak to the issue of dealing with the nuclear issue. Do you think there is a solution short of a military option for resolving this issue?
Think or hope?
Either one.
I certainly hope that there would be a political solution, although on day ago, Khamenei rejected American offer for direct negotiations. Let me put it this way. I don't think that Israel has a military solution. I would not be happy if they say that attack on Iran, because I don't think it would achieve the goals. It's a different story if there would be a broader coalition. I think military solution should be the last resort, but I will put it this way. A political solution would not succeed unless the Iranians genuinely believe that there is a military option against them. But as long as the Iranians are confident that nothing will be done to them if they go on, then there will be little to stop. That is, if you want to prevent a military solution, you have to keep a viable military solution open. By saying that this is not on the table, you, in fact, enhance Iranian self-confidence or maybe audacity. Will sanctions be enough? Frankly, I don't know. Maybe right now, no, but again, if you look at politics in the Middle East, they are totally unpredictable. That is, perhaps there are some undercurrent developments in Iran that may force the Iran government to change course within a few months. I don't know. That is, right now, it seems that the Iranians are defiant. On the other hand, if you look at the way Iranians are conducting themselves, it's interesting that the moment they advance too far, they go one step back. That is, for instance, they converted 50 kilos of enriched uranium to scientific purposes. Why? Because I think they didn't want to provoke too much, either the US or Israel. So maybe what we'll reach is not a resolution, but a postponement of this Iranian effort until, hopefully, there will be a political change within Iran. That is, again, it will maybe not be a total resolution, but some sort of partial progress, I don't know. But I don't think I can give you a clear straight answer.
Yes.
If I can, I'll continue on Iran. I want to take that advantage. First, I want to know, how do you evaluate the recent visit of Ahmadinejad to Cairo? And also, what about a Iranian spring?
Sorry?
How do you see it? Can we see a Iranian spring in Iran?
Okay. I think Iran has strove for many years. I mean, of course, Iran saw Mubarak forming Egyptian government as an Israelite. It was joyful when Mubarak fell. It had great hopes that the future Egyptian government would be close to Iran. If you look historically, by the way, the Muslim Brothers, unlike the Salafis, were never as hostile to Iran or to Shiites as Salafis. Because the Muslim Brothers historically viewed the West and Israel as greater challenges to the Muslim world. To give an example, in 2006, during the Israel-Hezbollah war, the Muslim Brothers were fully supportive of Hezbollah against Israel, where the Saudis had a problem, should they or shouldn't they pray for Hezbollah? Because who is worse, Shiites or Jews? You know, Salafis, by the way, regard Shiites as worse than Jews. It's a major achievement. now, the thing is, so the Muslim Brothers, in my view, wanted to achieve an improvement in their relations with Iran, maybe as the to counterbalance dependence on the U.S. or maybe on the Saudis. But I think that a rapprochement between Egypt and Iran, or full rapprochement, is highly unlikely to take place because of Egypt's economic problems, Egypt's dependence on Saudi and Qatari financial support. Secondly, as long as the Syrian civil war is going on, as long as Iran supports Assad, who slaughters Sunnis, it will be extremely difficult for a Sunni movement like the Muslim Brotherhood to ignore this issue. And you could see it, by the way, that when Ahmadinejad visited Sheikh al-Azhar, he scolded him for his support of Assad. And you could see criticism, even within the Muslim Brothers, against this Iran opposition. So this issue, I think, would prevent a full rapprochement from taking place between Egypt and Iran. Now, regarding the possibility of an Iranian spring, I would say that all the preconditions for such a spring are there. If you look at the economic situation in Iran, it's very bad. Look at unemployment. Official unemployment in Iran, before they ceased publishing data, by the way, which is significant, was 14%. Estimated to be closer to 17%, estimated to be about 25% when you look at young people. Inflation today is about 40%. Again, unofficial because there are no official data. Poverty has increased, and you can see, by the way, repression has increased. Iran has become increasingly much more repressive in recent years than ever before. Now, Iran was never a democracy, but it was a sophisticated dictatorship. And if you look at the process going on in Iran, Iran is becoming increasingly repressive. Just to give you one example, in 2011, Iran was number two in the world in the number of executions per year, more than 600 executions. China was number one, but Chinese population is a little bit bigger than Iran population. If you look at executions per capita, Iran was number one in the world. Executions in 2011, 2012, they became smart, they ceased publishing the number of executions. But if you look at human rights organizations, they speak again about more than 470 secret executions in Iran. More than that, they now resorted to public executions. No, on parks. You have this, so we call it
gallows.
Gallows, yes, but public gallows on
trains.
Trains.
Yes,
on trains. In public parks to deter people. So repression has increased. You see, again, it's a reflection that government is afraid. Now, why is nothing happening so far? And I always say so far because I have no choice, no way of knowing. I would say four to five reasons why nothing happens in Iran so far. One is the type of government. Iran is a dictatorship, but it's not an autocracy. It's a dictatorship of a social class, of institutions. You have a wide array of governmental institutions, of, let's say, from the government, police, Pasdaran, or Revolutionary Guards, various other organizations. For instance, they had what they call the bunyads, the foundations, of six huge financial foundations that provide jobs to millions of people, which are huge patronage machines. Such a government, first of all, has a much greater spread over the population than, let's say, other dictatorships. Secondly, because it's not a one-man show, it is a dictatorship of a class, the danger of the leader alienating his own people, which is what happened to Mubarak in Egypt, in my view, or to Ben Ali in Tunisia, is less so in Iran. So this is one thing. Secondly, repression. I think fear is an important factor in Iran yet. Now you can say repression in Syria was worse, true, but in Syria the barrier of fear has been broken, not in Iran. Third is nationalism. The Iran government is highly nationalistic. It is used in nationalism very successfully. Here the nuclear issue as a source of Iranian pride. The West wants to deprive us of technological development. The West wants to keep us backward. This is why Iran launched a so-called, possibly or not, this monkey to space or other things. We are on the top of the world. I think this helps the Iran government. Fourth is populist economic policy, which sacrifices the long-term future in favor of short-term buying popular support. The Iran government subsidizes many things. The Iran government spends a lot of money on the lower classes to maintain their support at the expense of the middle class. So again, they're squandering their oil money for the future, but they're buying support for the present. Another element is what's going on in the Arab world. If I am an Iranian, and I'm looking at the middle at Arab countries today, I would not be enthusiastic to have a revolution in my country. If you look at Syria, Egypt, Yemen, even Tunisia, there's nothing to be cheerful about. I mean, and many Iranians, in my view, believe or think that you have already won revolution in 79. The outcome was not that great. What guarantee do we have that if we will topple this government, the result will be much, much better? Will it be a civil war? Will it be destruction? Will it be another dictatorship? The combined effect of all of these factors has led, again, in my thinking, to a culture of apathy, political apathy. People are refraining from politics. If you look at Iranian youth, they're more interested in music, in poetry nights, in hiking. There was a wonderful movie produced several years ago, There Are No Cats in Tehran. Great movie, produced secretly in Iran, of a group of young people who are looking for a place to hold an underground rap concert. The interesting thing about this movie is that you have these young people who are totally alienated from the Islamic government. The word God is mentioned only once toward the end of the movie, in fact, in a critical note about God being silent over what's going on in Iran. But the point is, yes, they're totally alienated, but they don't care about politics, they care about music. Now, by the way, all the actors were able to flee Iran fled after the movie came out. So this is an indication of something much, much greater. Now, this is, again, the way I understand the situation right now. It can last for several more years. It can change tomorrow following a certain trigger, be it some major event of, let's say, I don't know, police shooting too many people in some demonstration, or a financial scandal, a natural disaster which the government fails to deliver, or I don't know what will happen, that can change it. But it can change tomorrow, it can last for another 7 years. In my view, there's no way of knowing when such a change will take place.
Let me add to that, what about a foreign intervention? Would that be a positive change from what we were just describing? putting the people against the government, or some of them argue depending
what kind of foreign intervention. I think if you can maybe convince the Iranian people, for instance, that the nuclear issue is not about Iranian honor, but you want certain policy of the regime, the world accepts Iranian rights for peaceful nuclear development, then foreign intervention can... I think there is a danger that a military intervention in the short run will play into the hands of the regime. I think there's such a danger. You can't exclude it.
Next. Go ahead, please.
I was just questioning what Secretary Panetta had just talked about in regards to the degradation of forces. How does Iran perceive that, and do they perceive it as a victory? And if so, how will they go into the U.S. talks that are upcoming?
Okay. Historically, of course, Iran has been an enemy of the U.S. For ideological, emotional, many reasons. Historically, of course, Iran still sees, in my view, the U.S. as its major enemy. The older generation, Khamenei and company, hates the U.S., but is still afraid of the U.S. The younger generation, people like Ahmadinejad, and or younger generation of the Pasdaran revolutionary guards, I think, again, my view, most of them hate the U.S., but they are less afraid of the U.S. Many of them believe, rightly or wrongly, that there is a change in the global balance of power. You know, following the Arab uprisings, some Iranian spokesmen said that what we are seeing is not only a regional change, but part of a global change. The decline of the West and the rise of Asia in the East. They see the U.S. economic crisis, budget crisis, balance of trade crisis, and so on, as an indication that the U.S. is a power on decline. Obviously, it enhances Iranian self-confidence and belief that in the long run, history is on their side. And that, of course, again, may push Iran to a tougher position in such negotiations. Now, I think, again, Khamenei, as much as he hates the U.S., is still cautious. This is why Iran is moving very cautiously on its nuclear development. My fear is that the younger generation of the radicals, not the people in the street, okay? As I said, they hate the U.S., they despise the U.S., they may totally underestimate the U.S., and they may be totally oblivious to Iran's own regional weaknesses. Let me give an example of what I mean. I think if you look at Saddam Hussein for a second, Saddam Hussein was a brilliant politician when he looked at Iraq, okay? I mean, he was brutal, dictator, murderer, etc. But he knew how to handle himself domestically. He had very little understanding of world politics. He had absolutely no understanding of American politics, which could make him sometimes more conscious, sometimes more dangerous. I think some of the Iranian younger generation hardliners may face a similar problem, that they don't understand, again, sometimes the inner power of democracies of the U.S., and they may wrongly believe that the U.S. is really a power in total decline, so that may push them to wrong policies. But this is, again, more in the long run, not in the future, but I think, again, right now, I think they have some greater self-confidence.
Returning to Israel, could you talk about Yair Lapid and his position on the Palestinian negotiations with Palestinians and how the political calculus inside the whatever coalition merges might look like vis-a-vis the Palestinian negotiations?
First of all, I wish I knew. But, okay, let's put it this way. Lapid, okay, Yair Lapid is the head of this new party that came out of nothing and made this very significant or impressive achievement of 19 seats in the Knesset. He speaks publicly for two-state solution. He speaks publicly against it is an Israeli interest. He said something very interesting. He said, my father did not come here to live in a binational state or in an Arab state. So he wants a two-state solution so that Israel will remain a state of the Jewish people. Now, he pushes Netanyahu, by the way, that one of the conditions for him joining government would be the government would go to negotiations, to more active negotiations with the Palestinians. Lapid may have his illusions on what Israel can get from the Palestinians. I think he deludes himself that Israel can get much more than he can really get. Or maybe he's doing it for, he knows what he's selling it to the public. I don't know. He is not a leftist in the sense that he see that he believes that it is only up to us, that if only we'll be forthcoming, every problem will be solved. But he also believes that there's problems on the Palestinian side. But he certainly wants to push Netanyahu toward, again, a more active path of negotiations. Now, the problem is that no one in Israel knows today what Netanyahu really wants. I'm not sure that Netanyahu knows, by the way, because I think Netanyahu is torn. Let me put it in parentheses. I never voted for Netanyahu. I don't like Netanyahu personally, okay? So what I'm saying now is of an involved party. You can say that I fail to distinguish between my personal views and my trying to be an impartial observer, okay? Netanyahu in his heart is very right-wing. Netanyahu in his heart prefers to have a right-wing coalition with the religious parties, ultra-religious parties, because they are what you call the natural partners, because he doesn't care about their social agenda as long as they support him on the Palestinian agenda. He is willing, in my view, to sacrifice Israel long-term economic development and social development in selling out to the ultra-Orthodox parties. Because for him, that's a partial price to pay for his agenda vis-a-vis the Palestinians. On the other hand, he's not stupid. He understands that right now Israeli public opinion wants a certain change, so he began to speak about greater equality and what we call burden sharing. Now, how much is it talk? How much is it simply tactics to delude the center to follow him and then dilute whatever sort of his more centrist policies, or how much he's genuine about it? I don't know. For me, the fact that he doesn't want to get rid of some of his ultra-Orthodox partners is not a good sign. But he may be forced to do so against his will, because there is no way he can pursue, he has now a major budget deficit. There's no way he can pursue any serious policy to cut the budget with his previous coalition. And if Israel will face a much more difficult situation vis-a-vis the world, he will need support from the center. So I think he's now trying to play between these two sides. Again, how will it end up, I don't know.
How would you evaluate U.S. policy in the region in the last couple of years, and what do you hope to do?
I think the U.S. has made several mistakes, the undiplomatic, for example. Let me say from the Israeli point of view, and then I think Obama made two mistakes vis-a-vis Israel. Okay? Both are psychological. I don't think Obama is unfriendly with Israel, but I think he's made two psychological mistakes. During his first visit in the Middle East, he skipped Israel. Now, we can say Israel is a paranoid, we can say Israel is insecure, and whatever. For many Israelis, it was a bad sign, it was a bad signal. The second mistake was to put the cessation of settlement as a precondition for any negotiations. Now, I'm against settlements, but it played into the hands of Netanyahu by enabling Netanyahu to present himself as the person who cares for Jerusalem, which for many Israelis is a very crucial point. So, and also, by the way, he put Abu Mazen on a very high tree that he could not come climb down. Abu Mazen said so himself. This was a mistake. Secondly, I think the U.S. in Egypt went too rash. Not that it could support Mubarak, okay, Mubarak was finished. But maybe in Egypt, the U.S. went too fast to have a complete change of government, whereas in Syria, it is too slow. That is, by staying totally out of Syria, the U.S. has enabled the Salafis in Syria to become much more powerful. That is, maybe if the U.S. would have extended help, not military involvement, but maybe help to the non-Islamist factors in Syria, they would have been stronger now vis-a-vis the Salafis in the future Syria. This, I think, I would say now. Regarding Iran, I think Obama, in pursuing sanctions, I support his policies. I think they're very good. I think Obama's policy in the Gulf, I'm not an expert on the Arabian Gulf, on the Arabian Peninsula, so I can't speak much about it. What I would like to see, first of all, I want America to heal itself, okay? I mean, the world needs a strong, healthy America. Let me put it very, very, okay? We can't afford to have a sick America. I think it's very blunt. A new American approach on the Israel-Palestinian track, I would say a more practical or realistic approach than would be helpful, both sides. And a way to balance American opposition to Iran without playing into the hands of the Salafis now is essential. How you do it, I don't really think I can give an easy answer, but I think this would be essential.
You have a question?
5 minutes.
Oh, okay. We are running out of 5 minutes, by the way. You can have a question. Any last questions? I know, Colonel, you had your hand up, but are you done?
Well, I think we might have addressed Adolf's question a little bit more. From a cultural perspective of Iran, with the Persian culture that has a strong narrative of ascendancy and a history of being persecuted all the time, is American foreign policy or any policy that puts pressure on them ever going to succeed, or will it always unite the population vice?
Historically, the UN government, this government came under pressure many times. I mean, these people are not, I mean, they're not nice people, they're not lunatics, they're not suicidal. You can see that on various occasions, Iran came in under pressure, or Iran gave preference to state interest over ideology, because they want survival beyond everything else. So I think that the right amount of pressure or the right combination of pressures can force the Iranians to make concessions. I don't think the Iranian people, again, as much as they agree with your assessment of their culture, these people are not pressurable. No, they're not, they are pressurable. Again, history is just proven so.
What do you know about the explosion in Fordow?
As far as I know, it hasn't happened. I don't know.
Okay.
Again, this is what the IEA said and what the U.S. government said. So
okay.
As a civilian, I have no way of challenging.
The last question to
General. You talk about the Iranians hitting Americans. You said that the Iranian
government. Not the Iranian government. No, make distinction.
What could be the reasons?
Why? First of all, the Islamist regime in Iran views the West historically as an enemy. The West is this ambiguous term, but Khomeini spoke of what he called an unholy triangle of the West, first Britain and the US, the Jews, and Western Iranians are responsible for the crisis of Islam and Iran in the modern day. The West is determined to control and subjugate the Muslim world. The West is determined to exploit Iran and destroy Islam. This was his ideology. And for them, American culture represents everything which is anathema to the right interpretation of Islam. Because in their view, what is American culture? It's unbridled materialism, consumerism, excessive individualism, and excessive moral promiscuity, which everything which is against Islam, the way Islam should be. American culture is the greatest danger to Islamic identity. It's not a coincidence that they call the U.S. the great Satan. Because in their view, American culture or American is like Satan. What is Satan? Satan is the thing that tells you, al-waswas, okay? That tells you to follow the wrong path, don't go to lectures and then drink beer instead, is American culture. This is why it's much more dangerous, by the way, than communism, because communism is too directive, and communism lacks the emotional attraction. Okay. Now, add to that American policy in the past, 1953 Mossadegh toppling, American support for the Shah, American policy in the region as a whole, and American support for Israel. All of the above. Present the U.S. in the eyes of the Islamic regime in Iran as the major enemy and the major threat to the Islamic Republic.
Okay. Thank you very much. I